Peel open the pages of your favourite print title and you'll likely find that the imagery on display is as integral to the magazine story as any number of written words. From photojournalism to the art of picture taking, we'll explore the role of images in print today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. It's been 45 years since what some might call the golden age of photojournalism came to an end, when Life magazine ceased to publish. But there are a few magazines carrying on the great tradition of rich photography on the printed page. We'll leaf through their pages shortly. But first, France heads to the polls this Sunday to elect a new president. Both far-right leader Marine Le Pen and centre-left candidate Emmanuel Macron are expected to make it through to the second round, but it has been very unpredictable right the way through the campaign. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco looks at how some of the French weeklies have been gearing up for the election with the French media correspondent Marie Billon.
Well, I would have thought that Valeurs Actuelles would back Marine Le Pen, but I checked their front pages and they haven't done a lot on Marine Le Pen. They've done more on François Fillon, and last week's edition was on François Fillon, and there's a lot of him in the covers and inside. So I think they're kind of betting on him because he's the one who more loudly says that he's a Catholic, and Valeurs Actuelles is a very Catholic right-wing issue. So he's the only one who is basically saying loud and clear, I have Catholic values and I want to uphold them as a president. Even Marine Le Pen doesn't say that loudly, basically. So in a way, François Fillon is the ideal candidate because he's not far right. He's from the mainstream centre-right party. But at the same time, he's very right-wing. And if you talk to French people, they would say that if there was to be a second round, François Fillon, Marine Le Pen, it would be right against far right in terms of the general picture. But socially, it would be a bit of the same because François Fillon is very much on the right side when it comes to family value, to conservatives' value. That's why Valeurs Actuelles is apparently backing him or at least doing a lot on him, which is a bit surprising. But again, François Fillon knows that Marine Le Pen is very much with the wind beneath her wings. So why not try and tap this this source?
But a part of the establishment, especially media, we have other magazines that also lean a little bit to the right, which is Le Point and L'Express. They are actually sticking for François Fillon, even after all the scandals. That's quite interesting as well.
Yes, yes, they are, very much so. What they do, I mean, Le Point, for example, we have this one in front of us. There's a picture of François Hollande looking very pensive, and the title is The Testament Interview. The basically, he's the president, outgoing president, is writing his will in Le Point, saying what you should remember from me when I'm gone. And some weeks ago, they made another headline with a very deaf-related headline. So basically, they are very clearly trying to put François Hollande under the ground and should rise another right-wing persona because Le Point is very much on the right and L'Express as well. The important for them is to show that the left is good to nothing, and they show that by criticizing a lot François Hollande. They also try to undermine Macron. I think it's Le Point, or was it Valeurs Actuelles? I can't remember, who made a big headline with a big headshot of Macron and written, Hollande, he's back, showing that basically Macron is just the heir to François Hollande, which is not exactly the case, but that's how they want to put it.
I read an article, I think it was at the Financial Times, saying that, you know, people have this image that French media is dominated by intellectual lefties. But from what I can see here, there's a resurgence of the right-wing commentary pages in France, or even publications like the ones you mentioned, which are quite, you know, I believe L'Express, for example, you know, does have a high circulation, you know, as you can find in all the major news agents, for example.
Yes, indeed. Well, Le Point, L'Express, and the third one would be the Nouvel Observateur that we don't have here today, but it's the main left-leaning magazine, the equivalent of Le Point and L'Express. And I don't know in terms of circulation, but all of them are very, very popular. And Le Nouvel Obs is very much backing the left. This week issue has a picture of the three main left candidates, Macron, Hamon and Mélenchon, saying, who is it going to be? So they clearly say, we are backing the left candidate. They just don't know which one. There's so many of them on the left as well. And there's another one, which is called Marianne, which is very much on the left, very bombastic magazine. I would compare it, in a way, paralleling Marianne with Valeurs Actuelles. Although, I mean, in terms of social issues, Valeurs Actuelles is very much out of the pack. Marianne is very much, I mean, proud of its politics. More outwardly than the other magazines.
Marie, we're talking about the weeklies. It's fascinating to have a look at the French weeklies. But let's talk also about another form of print media, newspapers as well, which are also very relevant in France. Which paper is backing who? Who is important in the election? If you can go through the main French newspapers and their political views for us.
Well, we know, for example, that Le Figaro is the one that is backing. Oh, I don't know if they back exactly. I haven't checked that exactly. But Le Figaro is very much the right-wing voice in terms of newspapers. So François Fillon would be their choice, although they covered as much as they wanted the scandals of François Fillon. I kind of feel that they've been quite easy on him, in a way, more than the left-wing media, who, of course, decided to jump on them. The left-wing media would be principally Libération. Libération would be a very much, well, not very much left-leaning, but clearly left-leaning. I must say, I don't know if they back Hamon or Macron. I would say they will be more like a Hamon type of magazine because they've been close to the Socialist Party, although they've been quite criticizing François Hollande as well. But I mean, if you open Libération, you know it's going to be left-leaning. If you open Le Figaro, you know it's going to be left-leaning. There's Le Monde as well, which is a very important newspaper. More left-wing in a way, but more open-minded in a way because it's open to the world. It's called Le Monde, which is the world. So it has a lot of international issues.
That was Marie Billon speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is The Stack on Monocle 24. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but in the case of the magazines that lay before us right now, a picture's worth surely far more than that. James Hyman, founder of the Hyman Archive, the world's largest magazine collection, no less, knows a thing or two about magazines, past and present, and he joins us now here in the studio. Good to have you back, James.
Thank you.
It's been a while. We think around a year, perhaps.
I think it was around about May when all the donations started flooding in.
Well, I was going to ask you about this. Let's have the numbers first to remind our listeners, or maybe inform them if they're not aware prior. What are we up to? What kind of size of collection now? It's significant.
Because we're focusing a lot on the business side and getting it digitized, we're not counting as vigorously and rigidly as we did. When it got in the Guinness Book of Records, it was 53,000 or so. It's doubled through those donations. About 280 different donors have totaled about another 60,000 magazines, and we're getting them every day. So conservatively, it's over 110,000 magazines.
That's quite a lot of magazines.
It is. So when you ask me to come here and sort of whittle things down, which is...
Just bring a few thousand in.
It's very hard.
So you haven't brought like a flatbed truck loaded?
No.
Just a tote bag or a backpack.
Six or seven.
With a few.
Can I just say, by the way, when you said that thing about a picture is worth a thousand words, you know that it was quoted and coined from an actual magazine or a newspaper? 106 years ago by newspaper editor Tess Flanders.
There you go.
You see?
Well, that's been rather the sort of motif of the show today. And I guess actually the use of pictures, brilliant photography is kind of it's always something that we talk about when we look at magazines, almost by definition, but we'll talk about that today. Give us a bit of an overview. What have you got? You've got a few titles, some old favourites, familiar names.
Yeah,
a bit of archive raiding's gone on. Where should we start?
I mean, an honorary mention to, I guess, Sunday supplements, colour supplements, which were designed really to literally breathe colour into the grey Sunday papers. So I just bought here a Sunday Times magazine from, about 30 years ago, May the 18th, 1986, with the headline, Even Punks Have Parents, and feel free to comment on that.
That's brilliant. Well, it looks a bit like one of my family shots from the 1980s.
Were you a punk?
Not quite. Yeah,
but you know,
very soberly dressed and austere parents.
Like a mini Boy George.
And then the sort of Boy George-esque tearaway.
But I'm just bringing that in again, the sort of the photojournalism, the reportage, to show the real importance of those magazines that, as I say, were brought in to add that dimension to Sunday papers.
And actually, leafing through to the photo essay, which is the cover story in the Sunday Times magazine, I mean, just brilliant shots, family portraits, and you can see these very reserved, slightly uncertain parents, and then these kids looking much happier with their lot in life. But that is interesting about Sunday supplements. I mean, I think we kind of forget now, there's such a barrage of imagery, full colour imagery as well. You forget what a explosive kind of presence, the change that made as they went from strength to strength. And, you know, like a lot of newspapers, as they went colour, it was relatively recently. I mean, that's the other thing that's amazing to think about.
Shall I go up to date? Bang up to date, really. They've just relaunched and redesigned the British Journal of Photography. I mean, you don't really get a better aggregator of photos and images. Look, honourable mentions again to Picture Post, Parry Match, Life and Time. I'll tell you why I chose that. Again, it's been redesigned, relaunched. But a lovely story, if you check our social media, the founder and editor or owner of British Journal of Photography, Mark, came down and donated their whole archive, both physically and digitally, to us, to the Hyman Archive. So that's one of the longest running magazines in the world, if not the longest running photographic magazine. Started in 1854. And I mean, you know, it does what it says on the tin, and images to pore over, analyse,
discuss. It's a beautiful thing. You know, some friends of ours as well, they've been on the stack fairly recently as well. And this is a truly beautiful journal. Well, is the cover image beautiful? It jumps out at you. Can you paint a picture of the cover shot for our listeners?
Three little pints of beer clasped towards a man's stomach.
Who looks like he's had a few already over a long period of time to paint the picture. But just astonishing, and again, you always forget about the sort of stocks in here. There's incredible glossy photo quality paper in here and all sorts in between.
I think the owner, Mark, would wax on about that. They really took pride in what stock they were going to do when they relaunched and redesigned. I mean, he gave me a whole rundown on that. But yeah, I'm honoured that we have that whole archive now.
What does that mean, Jeff? I mean, when you get, I don't know what to call it, almost a sort of a bequest, a collection like that. I mean, has it changed how you look at the archive? Because it started, I guess, you know, it's always been your personal passion, but it kind of feels like you're presiding over, you know, over something bigger than that now, isn't it? It's a resource, you feel like a community resource almost.
It really is. The stories that go with those donations, the people who, you know, we often tag it, it's the final resting place for magazines. And these people who kindly donate, really, you know, yeah, I guess there's a bit of responsibility. It's bigger than us all. I love, part of my vision for the project is it's like a community thing. It's the people's archive to an extent.
And what about, I guess, these donors give their collections, they're happy that it finds a place where it's going to be loved and looked after and preserved. What about the flip side? I mean, people presumably then in increasing numbers must come to you and say, can I have access to the archive? Do you have copies of this and this obscure title? It
Absolutely.
Must be amazing if you can connect people with things that they've long lost.
We are getting people requesting either a specific image, specific article, academics, students, creatives, which is why the logical conclusion for it really is two things: physically to have a museum and digitally to have it digitized, because we cannot
cope with that.
If 100 people want this magazine, this article, that image, to flick through all these New Yorkers, whatever we've got.
It's in your head somewhere, but that's not the easiest filing system, I guess,
exactly,
for external users. Where should we go next?
Okay, so I also chose, I mean, very difficult to do this, but on that kind of reportage, photojournalism, I went for Colours. Fantastic magazine, as you can see here. I've chosen, well, there's a war issue. That's a pretty gruesome shot there. Someone's head
that's
might be hard blown
to,
off.
Hard to look at.
Yeah, it was the genius warped mind of one of its founders, Oliviero Toscani. He was a former art director for Benetton. So again, I like the way this guy has creatively twisted and I guess perverted imagery in these magazines. I mean, look here, almost fetishized objects. This is another issue, Gifts for the Family, with a condom on the front cover.
And that's very much, people will be familiar with Toscani's kind of approach.
Yeah.
It's not to shock per se, but to shock as a byproduct of pushing the envelope was always something, you know, sat very comfortably.
Courted controversy.
And it's important, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think there was that famous thing where he had the AIDS patient dying in a bed, the prisoner on death row, but really pushing the power of image. So again, even mundane images like the one you're flicking through there, just Gifts for the Family, really striking the way he's made those objects jump out at you from a magazine.
And it's interesting, I wonder, on these more, I don't know what you'd call them, sort of confrontational images almost, is it harder to do that now? You know, there's more magazines, people on the internet can find pretty much whatever they want to find at the click of a few keys. Does that make it more difficult to
shock with your image selection, with your graphics? Or do you think in a way...
Maybe we're all...
It's a reminder of its power, actually, in print.
That's a good point. I mean, maybe we get anaesthetized by seeing so much stuff through visual media, and there's so much of an influx and glut of it now that, yes, harder to shock, but you can still do it. I mean, look, if you look back at some of the heyday of those colours in the 90s, they still shocked. You've just got to work harder at it. Interesting enough, actually, one point I wanted to mention, and it's a kind of weird sideline irony to this on that war sort of reportage stuff. On Facebook, I mean, that Pulitzer Prize guy who took that shot of the naked girl running down in Vietnam, there was that whole controversy, like Facebook kept censoring and pulling it down. I just find that interesting, again, the power of the image now almost being censored by these platforms.
Particularly, and particularly with that, you know, it was a news image. It was a
reportage. It was a Pulitzer Prize-winning image.
It wasn't an ad campaign for Benetton designed to sort of yank people's chains.
Absolutely.
It was a legit piece of documentary.
One of the world press photos as well in 73. Just quickly, the guy, Egil Hansen, he was editor-in-chief and CEO of Aftenposten, he wrote to Facebook about that image saying, it's a concern they were unable to distinguish between child pornography and famous war photographs, as well as an unwillingness to allow space for good judgment. I think that's interesting, again, how the image now is also being manipulated by being censored on all these platforms.
It's absolutely fascinating. James, it's an absolute delight. What's next? I guess you're still encouraging people to get in touch.
If you've got anything to donate or you need research, you do need images, articles, we are a resource. So hymanarchive.com. We are slowly but surely forging that path to digitizing. So support from rights holders, photographers, journalists, good people like yourselves, that will keep us alive.
And just a final note, is there anything that you're still tracking down?
Oh, yeah.
Is there an elusive particular? Is there a sort of, you know, the Kaiser Soze of magazines?
There's millions of them. I mean, honestly, that part of my anxiety is gone. I mean, literally after here, I was going to quickly rush to a good little haunt. The Book and Comic Exchange in Notting Hill, I put away a stash of stuff. I'd never even seen this before. Some music magazine called, I can't remember, Unfound, Unsound or whatever from the 80s. That is endless. There's millions of them. They're like mole bashing. Find one, million more sprout up.
In the best possible way.
Yes.
James Hyman, it's brilliant to speak with you.
Thank you for coming
to see us, as always. More power to you and the archive. Keep us posted with further developments. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24. We've just leafed through a few of our favourite titles that wear their beautiful imagery and photography loud and proud. You might say the same about our next magazine. Lodestar's Anthology is a triannual travel publication that delves into the depths of just one country every issue. Editor Liz Schaefer fills us in on the latest edition to hit the newsstands, which is all about Japan.
I think for the magazine in particular, what made me realise I probably wasn't the best traveller is I'm a slight snob. It's sort of everybody was coming back from Japan, sort of friends, family, and everybody just adored it for whatever reason. It's the sort of thing when you hear about a destination that everybody just falls in love with. You're like, really? Is it really that great? So I think I actually delayed doing the Japan issue for a long time, and that's why I felt like I wasn't the best traveller, because I was putting off this experience because other people thought it was so good. But of course, then you go there and you realise that you're an idiot and it's amazing and you start planning your return trip straight away.
But I completely understand, you know, when everybody's saying that it's fantastic, you almost try to avoid to be cool. But I guess, like, in a case like Japan, you can't do that.
No, drink the Kool-Aid, get on board.
And it is fascinating. I was, you know, looking through the magazine. It's interesting because, you know, every time I read something about Japan, you know, it's either something about Kyoto or just a guide to Tokyo, which I think in itself can be a magazine. But it's interesting, you did went through the whole country. Tell us about your experience. How long did you stay there for the mag?
Personally, I spent about 6 weeks there, but I didn't get to cover the whole country myself. I did Okinawa and the main island. We at this stage have a really lovely network of contributors, both based in the UK, Australia, and some really beautiful contributors based in Japan who gave us the most beautiful insight into their country. Because the thing about Japan, it is this place of amazing contradictions. Everybody has these images of Tokyo and Kyoto, and the country is a lot more than that. And once you get into the wilderness, like I walked through the Kei Mountains and sort of learned about Shintoism and Buddhism that way. And that was a completely different side to Japan that I had no idea really existed. This sort of nature worship and awareness of your place in the world and this deep sense of respect. And then you go from there out to Osaka, which is sort of this foodie capital. But again, it's so busy and so many people. And you're like, I can't believe these worlds exist an hour apart from each other.
another thing that is, you know, you can read in every issue of Lodestar, you give a lot of attention to the cuisine of the country, to food. And I think last time you came and spoke to Tony, we almost suggested maybe you can do a spin-off, you know, a food spin-off in a way. And Japan, again, fascinating for food as well. Tell me about your culinary experiences there.
The first thing I did in Japan was a hike. And when you're doing a hike with jet lag and getting over a chest infection, you're a little bit precious to begin with. And so about day two, I was just craving peanut butter and sourdough toast. Like it just wouldn't go away, this desire. Broke through that craving and I just became obsessed with sort of trying and eating everything. And with Japanese cuisine, the best thing is to not be nervous of it. You've got to try everything. Some of it will be quite shocking or quite sour or a completely new flavor. And sometimes it's best not to know where it comes from. I did eat horse and I did eat blowfish and I didn't know till after the fact. But it's just beautiful. This flavor, everything is so pure and there's this respect for ingredients. And it's really about stripping, I think, cooking back to the bare essentials and doing the most you can with the seasons and with flavors. And I think that's what is at the heart of really, really good food. And that is what defines Japanese cuisine.
And, you know, talking about food, I have some recipes here in the magazine as well. Like, for example, ikameshi, which is stuffed squid with glutinous rice. Have you tried this one?
I did not try that, but this was with an amazing Japanese chef who now lives in Paris. And it was necessary, I think, with this issue to actually have a closer look at food and include some recipes and have time discussing with the chef what it's like to bring Japanese flavors to the world, because it is that thing that is it's quite unknown and quite other, really. Everybody knows sushi and sashimi, but there's so much more than that.
And Liz, another thing that I've noticed, you're in, I believe, the seventh issue?
We are.
So we love a success story here in the Stack. So I want to know more about, you know, the business side of the magazine. Are you dealing with, you know, perhaps some advertising? Where is the revenue coming from? Like, are you changing your business model as you go through? Because it seems like the next issues, you know, you're already planning then. I believe it's even being announced in the magazine. The next one is New Zealand, I believe, right?
New Zealand and France.
Fantastic. So, yeah, I would like you to, if you could talk a little bit more about the business model for Lodestars.
I think from the outset, the idea was always to grow as organically as possible. I felt if the focus was always on having really beautiful, heartfelt, amazing content and building a relationship with your contributors and with your readers, then growth would happen, ideally, just as a natural side effect of that. And I feel that's what has happened, which I'm really grateful for. And, you know, we've done small things as we've done ourselves getting bigger. We've done a web redesign. We only recently introduced a shop to our website. But we have tried to do it quite organically. So when we do advertising, we look to do advertorial or find brands whose stories we think actually work as a story in the magazine rather than a very clear-cut, you know, advertising page. And fortunately, when you do have a country-to-country focus and you do have a very slow journalism approach to the travel and the way you show the country, tourism boards can be incredibly helpful. And I don't think I was expecting to get the level of support we had. I didn't think everybody would get the idea that we were doing, but we've been really lucky since, I think, the Sweden issue, just to have this amazing support from tourism boards.
But do you look at other travel magazines? I mean, because Lodestars is quite unique, especially because it looks at a country. You know, I've seen a lot of, you know, guides, magazines that focus on cities, but your approach is quite different. But do you have inspirations from other travel titles? Or perhaps is there one that you admire as well?
Oh God, where do you even begin with that? I think with independent print, though, it doesn't need to just be travel that you admire. I have a lot of respect for Slightly Foxed, which is a literary journal, but, you know, they do these really beautiful, in-depth, poetic, amazing pieces that you just get lost in. You know, Delayed Gratification have a very similar approach in that they are a slow journalism magazine. They take their time to really look at a story, and I think I'm inspired by them, but then you look at other magazines like Another Escape or Water or Serial, and, you know, that desire to show really beautiful photography and really beautiful writing and give young and upcoming writers a chance, I think that's always inspiring.
That was Liz Schaefer, editor of Lodestars Anthology, and the Japan issue is out now. We head back to France now, but enough of the politics. Time for something rather different. The Skirt Chronicles is a beautiful new title founded by Sofia Neviolo, Aide Tuitu and Sarah de Mavelle. The magazine reflects a new feminine voice and is organised chronologically with the content determined by the date of completion. We spoke to the founders about the launch of their very first issue.
There's two different things. The concept was bringing people together and collaborating with people we admire, may it be friends or people we would like to get to know better, whose work we admire or something. And that was the very core of the project and the concept. And then the name, it was, first came the idea of a skirt as maybe a way of representing women, and us three founders as women, but not necessarily. And then the idea that we wanted to convey with the Chronicles is that we wanted not to be yet another magazine, not to be a journal or something, but work with time and explore different generations, different places on the planet.
And, you know, if I may ask to Sophia, I saw that, I thought there was a great little story here with some pictures, like a spoon in the hair, and the photographs were by you, Sophia. I mean, tell us a bit more about this specific article and which type of stories do you want to cover at the Skirt Chronicles?
Well, this specific story was really a collaboration between myself and Sarah. We were always interested in about the how-tos, not the final example. So we were really interested in exploring that and giving our readers an ability to see each step of the way and how we kind of break down the steps of maybe it's putting an object into our hair, or in other ways we found that this magazine was really something to share our vision with people and to bring them a little bit closer to our world. The stories that we want to diffuse through the Skirt Chronicles are personal, are educational, are anything that our contributors don't feel that they have another place to explore their voice.
One thing that I would like to ask to all of you, before, you know, of course you created your magazines, I'm sure you worked in different fields. I wonder, what was your careers before the Skirt Chronicles?
So this is Aide speaking. I'm a writer, and before that I was working in cinema, but then since 3 years now I've been working freelancer for copywriting but also contributing to other magazines.
This is Sarah. By the past I was in working for fashion magazine. My first intern was when I was intern for the first time, it was at Purple. I was really obsessed by print magazine and especially the fashion one. And I still do that sometimes, some little research or stuff like that. But for the moment, it's principally Skirt.
This is Sophia speaking. And I, too, come from a writing and print background. I've worked for several magazines and continue to contribute to my close friends' independent magazines. As you can see, that common theme between the three of us really is printed matter. We're quite close. This is something quite close to all of our hearts that we read, we keep, we collect. So this is really where all three of us were passionate and where our idea came for the Skirt Chronicles.
And now I would like to ask a question about, you know, the magazine itself. Like, for example, where can you find the issue for, you know, how many issues will you have in 1 year? And perhaps if you guys have a business model for the magazine.
Well, Fernando, we are currently planning to publish the magazine twice a year. As we've said, our magazine is really based on collaborating with different people. So we'd love to continue collaborating, and if that proves to even publish more per year. But at the moment, our model is twice a year. Our business model was we really started this independently, and we hope to continue that in certain manners, in the fact that we sold our magazine online 2 months before its actual launch. So we started with this model of pre-order, and it worked quite successfully for us. We were really excited to see the response of people buying a magazine that they had never even seen in print, but were so captivated by its few images that we presented to them online.
The founders of new print title, The Skirt Chronicles there.
A
And that brings us to the end of this week's programme. Big thanks to our producers, Ben Ryland and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and of course to our editor, Claire Urban. Drop a note to Fernando. He's on fp@monocle.com. All comments or queries are welcome, but try to keep them polite if you can. If you fancy buying any of the titles mentioned on the programme, why not purchase them at the Kiosk Cafe, Monocle's own newsstand in Paddington, London, not too far from where we are here in Marylebone in London. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.